Mixed Martial Arts Point of View podcast may not be suitable for all audiences. Viewer and listener discretion is advised.
What's up, everybody? This is MMA Hall of Famer Randy the Natural Couture. Listen to Ant and Deontay on the MMA POV podcast. That's an order.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you once again for joining us. This is the latest edition of Mixed Martial Arts Point of View podcast. I am your host, Ant, and alongside me is the one and only.
It's me, it's Deontay, y'all. Happy to be back in the building.
Mixed Martial Arts Point of View podcast can be found on social media, on Facebook at Wrestling POV Podcast, on Instagram and Twitter at MMA POV Podcast. We can also be streamed by way of the following platforms: iTunes, iHeartRadio, Podbean, and Spotify. So, Deontay, as always, I got to start things out, you know, inquiring about your previous week. How was it?
It's weird in this space because I'm both fed up and encouraged. I'm fed up with all the nonsense that's going on in the country at this time, including the idiot in chief who felt the need to have a political rally in the midst of a pandemic in a state that is being especially hard hit right now. I was glad to see so many people were smart enough not to show up, even though a lot of people did show up. But I'm also that's the fed up part. Just seems like America has resigned itself to just quit and not take this pandemic serious. But I'm also encouraged by what I see out of the younger generations in the streets protesting, calling and asking for change. You see them. I would prefer that they all wear their masks and gloves, even though some are not. But, you know, I understand what they're advocating for. So that gives me encouragement. Man, how about you?
Before I actually answer your question, if you don't mind, I want you to dig in a little more in reference to where the idiot in chief held his rally, if you will. You know, just give us a little more history as to where he held it and how strategic he was and what the intent was in this decision. And, you know, what kind of, I guess, tone did it ring, you know, to those that, you know, witnessed such a decision or move?
Well, it's no coincidence, in my opinion, that he chose Tulsa, Oklahoma, to have his first political rally after the so-called shutdown or shelter-in-place quarantine type of thing we've been going through as a country. Tulsa, Oklahoma, for those viewing and listening, rather, who may not know, was the site of Black Wall Street, which was a collective of African Americans on the Greenwood Avenue area of Tulsa who were pretty much self-sufficient and were wealthy landowners. Not wealthy, but just, you know, they were self-sufficient. They didn't need anything. They were pretty much able to support themselves. And they had acquired, you know, land. They had acquired, or they ran businesses. They were successful people. And this was 1921. And then, of course, for those who you may not know, the white residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma, jealous of the prosperity that they were witnessing out of those African-Americans on that Greenwood Avenue section of Tulsa, decided to take it upon themselves to destroy it, pretty much burn it to the ground, kill as many people as they could stomach, and then, you know, take everything that was left from those African-American residents who have never been paid back for the land, the businesses, everything that was torn down by mob violence in a calculated effort with the support of the Air National Guard, who rained down bombs on those black people. No reparations have been issued for that ever in history. It took place in 1921, 99 years ago. And, you know, it's disgusting for him and his brand of politics, as we know, which is extremely racist, is extremely anti-black, to take place in that particular town at this particular time, knowing what he stands for. So that's kind of like the historical perspective of it, which to me just kind of makes it like it goes from what he already is, in my opinion, which is disgusting and inhumane, to something that's just subhuman. grotesque. I don't even have the vocabulary to describe how much contempt I have for the idea of Donald Trump. And I say the idea because he's a man representing an idea that has always been around in this country. He's just the latest iteration of that idea. And he's also a member of a party that created that monster, and they kept that monster locked away for so long, letting it out in intervals in recent history, that now you see the monster is fully grown and become what we now witness, and they can't put him back in the closet. But they don't really have a problem with the policies and the judges and all the things he's having. They don't have a problem with that. They have a problem with the style. They want him to be less vocal about it. In other words, he says the quiet part out loud, which is what they have a problem with. So you know, all of that's converging on this, you know, political rally, which actually, you know, actually ended up being, you know, somewhat of a failure, I would say, because they kind of, his campaign people kind of pumped it up. We, you know, you would see them on TV. We have millions of ticket requests. We have, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people, so many people that we set up an overflow stage, and we're going to have celebrities who are going to give concerts, and they're going to talk, and it's just going to be this just almost festival-like atmosphere of just white supremacy. And you'll see how great it is and how many people love our dear leader. And what ended up happening was you had, you know, an extremely unmotivated amount of people show up. Well, the people who showed up were motivated, but I mean, in terms of the people that they said were going to show up, didn't show up. They didn't have an overflow crowd. There was no concert. There was only the people who were in the arena, which was, I believe, the fire department said 1/3 full. So, you know, all of that nonsense is what has me fed up this week, you know. So that's just trash.
I cannot agree with you more. I honestly can't. As for me and how I'm doing, I too was disturbed by, you know, the strategy and the plan that went into Trump's initial rally for 2020. Then I, you know, achieved another emotion of pride and gladness and joy as a result of the weekend that was Juneteenth. You know, just looking at how not only the black community, but supporters of the black community went out in droves to, you know, express their pride in how, you know, we were finally liberated from slavery. And while the record books suggest it took place in 1865, we initially were liberated in 1863. However, they tried to, you know, keep that information from us and keep us in the dark, and we finally caught wind of it and, you know, exercised our freedom. And, you know, just looking at where we are, you know, I think of one of my favorite songs from the rapper Common, So Far, where basically the chorus says, "We have come so far, but we've got so far to go." And I say that because, you know, there is still a problem with many embracing, you know, other races and ethnicities in this country, and them being able to, you know, operate in the same freedoms as, you know, the bigoted racists once do. So, you know, just to see the pride that people displayed in Juneteenth weekend from you know, the parades and the rallies to, you know, seeing people promoting the importance of shopping through and making purchases and consumptions through black businesses. You know, it just gives me hope that, hey, we're far from done. We're here to stay. And, you know, and everything isn't just about not only just the black community in itself, but the people who have love and show support for us, and the people that are about solidarity and unity. You know, it really touched me in a positive manner. And even on, you know, Father's Day, just seeing the timelines filled with love and, you know, filled with encouragement and inspiration, and, you know, even messages for people who or mothers or co-parents who may have issues with their child's father. It was one of those things where let's not project those messages today. Let's try to find something positive to highlight and just, you know, elevate fathers and give them the love and appreciation that they deserve, especially those that are actively involved in their children's lives. And for those that aren't, you know, pray for them. You know, I truly believe that God is a God that convicts, he pierces hearts, and, you know, just maybe that father, that individual, those individuals will eventually see the errors of their ways and, you know, try to fix them. So I, you know, pretty much walked out of this week feeling good and hopeful.
Good, moving forward.
Yeah.
Positive.
Yeah. So one person who may not necessarily feel hopeful, especially when it comes to his lead cash cow, would be Dana White. Uh-oh. So our MMA Hot Topic of the Week goes like this. Dana White opens the curtain on Conor McGregor. In response to Conor McGregor's retirement, Dana White lifted Conor's kilt, exposing the fact that Conor McGregor was first to get offered the UFC 249 fight after travel restrictions prevented Khabib Nurmagomedov from traveling back to the United States after the whole Abu Dhabi debacle. McGregor declined the fight because he's not a replacement fighter, he says. Yeah, I get that, but during the pre and post UFC 246 interviews after he was victorious over Donald Cowboy Cerrone, McGregor stated in said interviews that 2020 was his fight season and he'll fight all of these mouthy fools respectively, talking about any and everyone that had something to say about Conor McGregor's return. Knowing this, Deontay, what is your take on Conor McGregor, or do you view Conor McGregor any differently knowing that he had a chance to put himself in position to get an eventual title shot against Khabib, but he backed out because he's above being a replacement fighter?
Not at all. I view him the same. He's the type of person who is going to ensure that whatever he does gets the most eyeballs and the most money. And that's what it's really all about. I mean, he's not, make no mistake, I think he's a committed fighter. I think he's definitely not necessarily afraid to fight anybody or afraid to take a fight on short notice. But I think at this point in his career, he is more of a businessman than, say, that young, hungry fighter he once was to climb the ranks and beat everybody who stood in his way. You know, there's a certain level of comfort you get with your achievements and the money that you've made and your status and your sport once you reach certain heights that you feel like the things that you used to do, the sacrifices that you used to make in terms of putting up with certain things, you're above that now. You know, you're above that now. So so I look at him the same way. He's going to do whatever maximizes his pocketbook and the eyeballs, because he wants the attention and he wants the money.
Absolutely. For me, you know, when I hear a fighter say, this is my fight season and I fight any of these mouthy fools, and then you contradict it by not fighting because, you know, you're above being a replacement fighter. It makes me wonder, you know, where exactly do you stand? Now, far be it for me to suggest Conor is ducking anyone or scared of anyone, because he wouldn't be doing what he's doing if he did have fear of whoever stands across the octagon from him. But it's just one of those things where it's like, dude, what is it going to be? Are you fighting or are you not fighting? Right. I mean, are you legitimately in the game or are you an attention whore? You know? And then And truth be told, when you look at the big, broad picture in reference to Conor McGregor, and I actually had this conversation with one of our bros from the good Delaware State University,
yes,
TJ Warren Thompson. Yes, sir. We had a conversation on Father's Day about Conor McGregor, and we both, you know, pretty much came to the agreement and understanding that we're actually surprised that Conor McGregor has actually returned to the UFC. I mean, he says he has a love for the game, but let's be real about it. A guy who's averaging $3 million a fight with the UFC steps away, fights Floyd Mayweather, gets $100 million just for one outing. How do you go back? You know, and thankfully he does have things in place like, you know, Proper 12 whiskey and other endorsements that fatten his pockets. But truth be told, I am so surprised that Conor actually made his way back to the UFC. I just knew we wouldn't see him again because, again, we're talking $100 million versus $3 million. Right. Apples to oranges. Mm-hmm. I mean, apples to breadcrumbs, right. Like night and day. So, more than anything, if his head, you know, my thing is, if your head is really in it, come on, fight, right. And do what we love to see you do. If not, make a sound decision to move forward. Now, I get it. You know, a lot of fighters do want more money, and I understand that. It's kind of hard to achieve that now since they're, you know, since audiences aren't being allowed into venues, which means there's no gate money. Right. But I get UFC fighters wanting to get more bread. I can't blame them. I mean, the sport has been in effect for what, or the organization has been in effect for 27 years now. Not only that, but the numbers are still being, you know, tabulated, but it is estimated that UFC's 2019 revenue will range anywhere between $980 million and $1.1 billion. Why isn't fight pay increased? So I get why Cejudo and Jones and Masvidal and Conor are, you know, not too excited about coming back. Something needs to be done to give these guys, you know, what they're actually worth.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point. I think that's that makes a good argument for
Before you continue, let me note this, that fighters actually get 18% of revenue share, which to me is an absolute insult.
That's 18%, that's exactly where I was going with it next, right? So
my man,
you actually foreshadow exactly what I was about to say, because we see the pay disparity or the lack of pay that they get from their bouts. Unless you reach that upper echelon, there needs to be more parity there, and that definitely lays the groundwork for UFC fighters, if they feel so inclined, to get together and establish a union, because right now, it's Dana White's way or no way, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, one guy, Dana White, and I'm sure Dana White has a staff of people working behind the scenes as well, but really nothing happens unless Dana White really wants it to happen. And that, to me, has been something that people have put up with because of the way he's elevated UFC to the top of the mountain as far as mixed martial arts is concerned. However, there's only so long that can continue to happen before fighters start to realize that, hey, okay, well, you know, I'm not seeing the money I want to see. I'm not seeing the type of whatever it is that I want. I'm not getting it.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to get 100% of what you want as a fighter, but at least, you know what I'm saying, a lot more than what I'm getting. I mean, I liken it to a period of time where Don King dominated boxing in terms of, like, heavyweight boxing from a promoter standpoint. And it was that way for, what, a good maybe 20 years? Don King really dominated things, and then all of a sudden, when his fighters retired or went away, it was already understood from the newer fighters coming up that they wanted better representation or better promoters, and Don King is no longer in the game, you know what I'm saying? And now the main villain in the game, of course, is Bob Arum, so to speak. So I think it's a good opportunity for fighters to, especially the superstars, to kind of combine and get their heads together and come up with a solution for parity in their pay via labor unions. I think that's a good idea.
I agree wholeheartedly. I agree completely. So as mentioned, you know, we do have fighters who unfortunately are taking a stance, but we do have fighters that are, you know, currently active and still fighting even in the midst of their contempt or resistance towards the current pay scale. So this past Saturday night, we had UFC Vegas 3, and the marquee bout for that was heavyweight Curtis Blaydes against Alexander Volkov, and pretty much the winner of this fight would, you know, catapult themselves a step closer to a title shot once the heavyweight championship smoke clears between Daniel Cormier and Stipe Miocic. So, by chance, did you actually see any of the action this Saturday?
The main event. The heavyweight fight. My man.
All right.
my man, Super Ugly, who looked like he had, he looked like he had the Versace logo, like cut into his head or something.
I don't know who his barber is, but his barber has legit skills. Yeah, like, this dude keeps a fresh fade with designs.
With designs, and I mean, that's not, that's, first of all, ain't nobody trying to sit in a barber chair that long to get nothing. That's too much, man.
First.
That's ridiculous. But, yeah, man, I watched the heavyweight main event, and let me get your opinion on the main event. If you want to,
Sure thing. So, Curtis Blaydes versus Alexander Volkov. Curtis Blaydes beat Volkov by way of unanimous decision. He set a takedown record for the heavyweight division, scoring 14 takedowns. And that might be an overall UFC record. If not, he's no lower than second. So he landed a total of 14 takedowns to Volkov's one. He outstruck Volkov in a significant strike department, 69-31. In reference to total strikes, Volkov actually outlanded Blaydes 127-116. But again, 14 takedowns, that's an insane amount of work. Unfortunately, Blaydes caught a lot of heat from, you know, lookers on, as well as Dana White. I have to go back and watch the press conference, but, you know, roughly based on what everyone said on Twitter, Dana White stated that Blaydes looked stupid, and he, you know, complained about Blaydes, you know, looking fatigued as the fight pressed on, because I want to say the backstage reporter was Laura Sanko, and so she had mentioned that Blaydes had a Cain Velasquez type of performance. And for those of you familiar with Cain Velasquez, like, he hands down is one of the most well-balanced heavyweights the UFC has ever seen. The guy can strike as well as he can wrestle. And so a lot of people feel like Curtis Blaydes is the next coming of Cain Velasquez. So when Laura Sanko made that comparison, Dana White was like, well, he punched like Cain Velasquez, but he didn't have the cardio that Cain Velasquez did. And don't get me wrong, I know Dana White knows the game. Mm-hmm. You know, he was involved in boxing prior to his ascent into the UFC and becoming the president. But Dana, you haven't fought anybody. So for you to critique, and not to say that Dana can't fight, I won't go that far, but for you to critique a fighter's performance, especially when he was dominant, and you're, you know, critiquing him, negatively critiquing him because he got tired, that's asinine to me. Let me see you lift someone up and slam them repetitively for 14 times in a 25-minute time span, and see if you too can maintain the same cardio you did when the fight first started. I'm just looking at Dana White like, dude, and I think, and it's funny because Melissa pointed this out to me, your arch rival in reference to the pay-per-view points
the
game.
The enemy she has said, entered the room.
So what she said, which made a lot of sense. So earlier I had mentioned how Curtis Blaydes, you know, is one of the active fighters that has expressed contempt towards UFC's current pay scale. So specifically, he said something along, and I won't say specifically, but roughly along the lines of, you know, he's unhappy with UFC's pay scale and there needs to be, you know, more money coming forth in reference to the fighters that, you know, pretty much lay their lives on the line every time they step into the octagon. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Melissa was like, you got to understand, Dana is speaking out of butthurt because Curtis Blaydes is yet another fighter to call out UFC and its insufficient pay scale. And I said, you know what, that makes a lot of sense because I can't see why a performance that great, despite his fatigue, which is understandable, got the heat that it did from the president of the company. And, you know, Dana White, he and his emotions, man, that's one thing that bothers me about, you know, how he does business. He gets so emotionally involved that he loses, you know, his sense of professionalism. I'm like, dude, you look so sensitive. Like, man up and chill out and be professional.
Yeah, man, his t-shirts are way too tight and he's way too aggressive, man. You know, I would have to agree with you, man. I remember when I was a young man, really young, maybe 11 years old, I played soccer for Oxon Hill Boys and Girls Club. We had a soccer match It was just like really hot that day, man. And we were outside, and
I'm sorry, you have the boxer, you had the soccer shorts that came above the dimple of your thigh.
Hey, brother, listen, I was 11. You know what I mean? I get it. I was 11. I think my mother had some old pictures of me in my soccer uniform too. Oh, man. It was just like really hot that day, man. And it was an early Saturday morning. It was like, it had to be like in the 80s, even though it was early Saturday morning. And I remember it was a game where my mother actually came to the game. And the team we were playing, I can't remember who we were playing, man. They had this guy who was just like really fast, man. I think he was a forward. He was like really fast, okay, man. He's a forward or wing, whatever you call it. I'm not sure. But he handled the ball a lot. He took a lot of shots because he was so fast. So I remember, right, just feeling like that was the first time in a soccer game I have felt like, man, I am tired of running. This dude is fast. And all he did was sprint at all times with the ball. I'm like, man, this dude is crazy. So I was kind of dragging a little bit. So at halftime, coach pulled everybody to the side. He looked at me. He was like, man, you got to run. That's your man. You got to run. And I looked at him. And with all of the base I could muster for an 11-year-old child, I said, why don't you run, coach? That guy's fast, and I'm sick of running after him. and my mother was like, you don't talk to your coach like that. I don't disrespect coaches. I don't advocate for that. But I was so mad in that moment. Like, dude, you don't even know what's happening out here, man. You from the sideline yelling stuff. But, of course, my coach plays soccer, so he understood very well. But it kind of goes back to what you said about Dana White. He's not a fighter. He doesn't know. In looking at the heavyweight bout, the last three rounds, I kind of felt myself thinking, like, did Curtis Blaydes do a lot of cardio training? Because he just did a whole lot of laying down on top of dude and breathing heavy, and then
what's known in the game as laying and praying.
Laying, he did a lot of that, but at the same time, I would not call him out with the aggressiveness that Dana White did. The reason being is because what you already mentioned, it is very hard to move around all that weight for that long period of a time, and then have to have someone else's weight, which is equal to your weight or more, or around the same weight, also leaning on you. You're dodging punches, you're dodging kicks, you're grappling on the ground. I mean, it's a lot, man. I get it. It's not entertaining to watch, and it does make you think maybe he didn't train as hard as he should have trained, but at the same time, man, I get it. So I found the fight to be less than entertaining than I would have hoped for a main event, but without question, Blaydes dominated the fight to me. Without question,
indeed.
Whenever he got in trouble or the his opponent looked like he might be gaining momentum, he just got his ass slammed. So, I respect Blaydes.
Yeah, absolutely, and he has solidified himself as arguably, let me not say solidify. He has put himself in position to be the next contender for the belt, but there is a stumbling block in his way by the name of Francis Ngannou. Not only because of what Francis did to Rosenstruck back at UFC 249 with that insane 20-second knockout, but Ngannou has beat Blaydes twice. So the question is, do you then go forth with a trilogy fight to further solidify who the next contender is once Stipe and DC resolve their issues, or do you just by default push Francis into the forefront as the next contender after those two fight, and then the winner of Francis and that champion will then face Curtis Blaydes? Like, how do you book that?
It's a good question, man. I wouldn't mind seeing Francis fight Blaydes, though. I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Go ahead with the
trilogy. I think that's gonna be a good fight.
Yeah.
I would definitely like to see that.
I believe too. I can't lie. I mean, I could go with either result and I'd be fine with it. So, one fight that did not have issues in the cardio department was the co-main event. Josh Emmett and Shane Burgos. My brother, if you get a chance, please go watch this fight. You may find what I'm about to say as being bold, but I'm comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. This fight here only pales in comparison to Joanna Jędrzejczyk and Zhang Weili as a fight of the year candidate. It only falls behind that fight. Oh, that's the only fight that it falls behind right now. Of the few fights that I have listed as fight of the year candidates, I'm comfortable with placing that second undisputedly behind Zhang Weili and Joanna Jędrzejczyk.
High praise.
The bomb, the bombs that they hit each other with were ungodly. Mm. Most men would not have survived three rounds. The strike totals, 128 Burgos, 127 Josh Emmett. There was a one strike differential. What made the difference in this fight was that Josh Emmett scored a takedown, and he was able to knock Burgos down twice throughout the course of the fight. But when I say you could split a hair, you literally could split a hair. Mm-hmm. That's how close this fight was. I mean, it was insane, the shots that they caught each other with. And I just found myself screaming, how was he still standing? This is insane. What do you mean he's not knocked out? Please go watch this fight. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. And I'm almost comfortable in saying that you will agree that this was the second best fight of the year thus far.
I'm going to have to watch it because I love when UFC fights give you that nonstop action, big shots. And, you know what I mean? That's just, man, I love it.
It just to help further ignite your excitement for the fight, this came off to me as a Mickey Ward or Toro Gotti type fight. Just an absolute slugfest. Both of them just pulverizing one another with bombs.
Refusing to lose.
That's it.
I love it, man.
That's it.
I love it.
That's it. I promise you. Now, moving on to the, I guess, sandwiched fight of the card, of the main card. Raquel Pennington beat Marion Renau by way of unanimous decision. Raquel Pennington outstruck Renau 107-46. Renau did land two takedowns to Pennington's one, but there was such an imbalance. And one of the editors that I work with Overtime, Heroics MMA, his school teacher, his high school teacher, is actually one of Renau's coaches. And that young lady is on her way. She legitimately has what it takes to be a force to be reckoned with in the women's bantamweight division. But unfortunately, she ran into a brick wall that is Raquel Pennington, who was a seasoned veteran at 135. And it was just one of those fights where you see the potential of Renau, but not just yet.
Mm-hmm.
Not just yet. All right, moving forward to the second fight from the opening bout. Bilal Muhammad defeated Lyman Good by way of unanimous decision. Strike count 82-81 in favor of Muhammad. Muhammad landed two takedowns, and I guess he was able to pass guard and, you know, gaining ground control on him, but that was yet another close and good fight. And the, I guess, side story to this is Lyman Good recently lost his dad on last week, and so he fought with a heavy heart. But that information didn't come out, apparently, until after the fight. And so hats off to him for sticking it through and actually competing, knowing that you just lost your dad on last week. I cannot even imagine, you know, especially considering his fight took place the eve of Father's Day. I can't even imagine fighting with such a heavy heart. And again, you know, every time I think of an athlete performing despite the loss of, you know, a major figure in their family, I go back to that Brett Favre Monday night performance against the Raiders, you know, on the heels of his dad winning and him lighting it up the way he did under the Monday night lights. It's commendable for an athlete to press on despite such a loss.
Yes, it is.
And then the opening card, Jim Miller defeated Roosevelt Roberts, and it only took 2 minutes, 25 seconds of the opening round to secure a submission win. The total strike count 2-1 in favor of Jim Miller. And pretty much the way this fight played out was they both met each other at the center of the octagon. Roberts threw this weak leg kick. Jim Miller, who was one of the best grapplers in all of UFC, is the type of fighter where if you're going to strike him, you better bring it full force. I mean, this was one of the softest leg kicks I've ever seen in my life. As a result, Miller got a hold of his leg, took him to the ground, punched him a couple of times, secured his back, and choked him out with a rear naked choke. And that's how the opening card played out. For, I guess, information in reference to the rest of the card with the prelims, you know, please feel free to go to ESPN.com as well as UFC.com, and you can see, you know, everything, how it broke out. You can also check me out on MMA POV podcast, where, you know, I highlight my picks. And, you know, you see my picks versus the actual results. And this week I did pretty good. I went 7-5 overall for the card. So I did pretty decent. But, you know, always aiming for perfection.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking of perfection and desiring greatness, Dana White bestowed unto us some gifts. And as a result, fight fans are in for Christmas in July and August. UFC President Dana White dug into his bag of goodies and bestowed upon us an abundance of MMA news. Those gifts include the official announcement of Fight Island with picks. And if you have not seen the picks yet, please take a look at them when you get a chance. It literally looks like an adult playland. And, you know, just to touch on Fight Island a little bit more, Jorge Masvidal, in so many words, said, "Wait a minute, you mean to tell me you don't have enough money to pay or to increase fighters' pay, but you got money to build an island?" That's a legitimate gripe to me.
It seems like facts.
Yeah, that's a very legitimate gripe.
Seems like facts. Take some of that island money and put it in our pockets.
There it is. So, fights for Fight Island include UFC 251, which will entail Kamaru Usman defending his welterweight championship against Gilbert Burns, who we just saw lambast Tyron Woodley. Alexander Volkanovski will see Max Holloway in a rematch for the men's featherweight championship. Peter Yan will face Jose Aldo to determine the new men's bantamweight champion as a result of the belt being vacated thanks to Henry Cejudo's retirement. Rose Namajunas will face Jessica Andrade in a rematch, where Andrade surprisingly beat Namajunas to become the women's strawweight division champion. And then opening up the bout will be Paige VanZant against Amanda Ribas. And just to give you an idea, Paige VanZant was one of the targets of Curtis Blaydes' tirade a couple of weeks back, where he was talking about pretty women who are only on the roster because of their looks as opposed to their fighting skills. So I'm sure she's looking to, you know, in one way or another, shut Curtis Blaydes up and put on a performance that warrants her staying on the UFC roster. But the kicker to this is actually Paige VanZant's last fight on her current UFC contract, and word has it that she's very likely to jump over to Bellator to join her husband. And forgive me for forgetting the gentleman's name right now, but, you know, word is that she's very likely to, you know, forego signing an extension with the UFC and joining her husband in Bellator. And prelims for UFC 251 have yet to be determined. Another announcement is that Daniel Cormier and Stipe Miocic will resolve their issues by way of the trilogy. The fight card in its entirety the rest of the fight card has yet to come forth, but DC and Stipe will hash out their differences on August 15th at UFC 252 in Fight Island. You have any pre-fight thoughts on the trilogy?
I want Cormier to win, and I want him to stick to what he does best and not worry about trying to impress critics or detractors or even trying to win fights by utilizing the other person's best techniques. I just want him to do what he does best and get a W, because I actually enjoy watching him fight and I enjoy his analysis on bouts. So, but I think sometimes he brings it. Other times, it's like he's uninterested. So,
I actually like both Stipe and DC. It'll be like watching my two sons scrap it out in the backyard. Mm-hmm. So any result that comes forth, I'll be pleased with. But like you, whether DC wins or loses, I want to see him fight his fight. And like you said, not get consumed in trying to please critics or prove to the fighter, his opponent, that he could do what they do better than they can.
Right.
Another fight that was announced, Israel Adesanya and Paulo Costa will duke it out for the UFC middleweight championship, but a date has yet to be determined. As a possible added bonus, both fighters will coach the return of the Ultimate Fighter series. Now, I don't know if you've actually followed the Ultimate Fighter, but it was a reality series where you have two UFC veterans that were eventually going to meet one another at the next pay-per-view. And so they're basically coaching their two teams of fighters. And at the conclusion of every show, one fighter from each team faces off in the octagon, and it continues in that fashion, along with, you know, just seeing the guys interact with one another in the Ultimate Fighter house until one winner is left standing. And so the winner actually is determined at a UFC non-pay-per-view event where the main event is the two representatives from each team. The winner of that event gets a UFC six-figure contract and a trophy highlighting that they are the Ultimate Fighter and that they are officially a UFC fighter. Have you ever seen the Ultimate Fighter, or do you have any knowledge of the Ultimate Fighter?
Yeah, I have seen it. I have knowledge of it. I've never been really interested in it. It's like if the Housewives or Love and Hip Hop have steroids and they punched each other. it's just a lot, man. It's just too much. I want to see the fight, man. Just, you know, yeah. But what I will say I do like about it, though, is they do get into the in-depth nature of some of these guys' stories, but some of these guys have some great backstories, man. I love that aspect of it. So that part of it is good, but it's just all the unnecessary arguments and, you know, all the protein and steroids. Come on, man. I understand why it could be for MMA junkie. I understand why they would, why they love it. So, and there has been some great seasons of it. I understand, and there has been some fighters who have come from it who have been successful. So, I get it. I mean, again, Dana White, a masterful marketer. Yes, he's very good at growing his product. No question.
That he is. Okay, another announcement that came forth, UFC on ESPN 12, which is actually this upcoming Saturday, and the main card goes as follows. Former UFC interim lightweight champion Dustin Poirier will face Dan the Hangman Hooker. In a co-main event, Mickey Gall faces Mike Perry. Brendan Allen will face Ian Heinisch in middleweight action. Maurice Green in heavyweight action will face Gian Vellante. And Aspen Ladd was supposed to face Sarah McMahon in the opener of the main card, but unfortunately, Ladd suffered an injury. That fight has been canceled, and as it stands right now, McMahon does not have a dance partner for this Saturday, nor has a replacement fight been announced to fill that void. Do you have any thoughts on this upcoming card, especially Dustin Poirier and Dan Hooker, which is the marquee matchup of the card?
It's hard for me to have an opinion on it because I'm not very familiar with those guys. I'm vaguely familiar. I'm not as familiar as say you are. What's your opinion on it?
So I think Poirier and Hooker are gonna put on an absolute striking clinic, but Hooker is vulnerable in the area of the ground game and submissions. I think Poirier's experience and his savvy will outlast the upcoming lightweight. And even though Hooker is trending in the right direction, I foresee Poirier stifling his momentum at least for one fight before, you know, Hooker can return to ascending towards, you know, championship opportunities.
All right. So it sounds like you're hopeful that the Hooker will be successful.
No, I got the Diamond, Dustin Poirier, beating Hooker.
So you got Dustin Poirier beating the Hooker.
Beating Dan Hooker, yeah. I think that Dustin will, you know, stifle Hooker's momentum. I hope I said that correctly, but yeah. I got Poirier stifling Hooker's momentum.
I feel you. I'm gonna ride with you on this one, man, because right now I'm being dominated by Melissa and I don't like that. All right. So, and I don't have the required UFC MMA knowledge to pick a winner in this particular bout, you know, picking up, being sure of who I'm picking. So I'm going to have to ride with you because I want to beat Melissa. That is the purpose.
That's the purpose of this whole
thing. Everything is about beating. I will not be dominated.
I got you. Now, keep in mind, this is a non-pay-per-view card, so this specific event won't count towards the pay-per-view points game, but UFC 251, 252, and 253 will. And I had to mention 253. Mm-hmm. Why? Because Dustin Poirier's last opponent, your favorite fighter, mm-hmm. Khabib Nurmagomedov, will return to action facing Justin Gaethje and determine who will be the undisputed lightweight champion.
Khabib.
Oh, and by the way, thank you for giving your answer. But good news has come forth in reference to Khabib's father that his health is progressing in the right direction despite multiple scares. You've already said that Khabib is going to win. Would you care to go in depth as to why you're going with Khabib to win?
He's my guy. I mean, I love Khabib because when he steps into the octagon, it is time to fight. He puts a lot of pressure on fighters. He only knows how to fight one way, and that is aggressive. And he is willing to lay it all on the line. And I think as combat sport fans, even people who are more boxing sport fans than say, MMA fans, whatever, if you like sports where people have to fight each other and one person has to dominate another to be considered the winner or to be declared the winner, I should say, then you absolutely love to see fighters who lay it all on the line and just go out there and just give it everything. And you can tell they're not interested in cheating anybody out of seeing them give their best in a fight, man. It just, whenever I see him fight, it really does remind me of the good old days of the old welterweights, Leonard Hagler, you know, Hagler, Hearns, you know, Hearns, Leonard. I mean, just those fights, man. Duran, Leonard. I mean, just crazy, crazy amounts of I'm not losing this fight type of aggression. So, yeah, that's why I love watching Khabib, man. And I like his hat. So, that is also.
Oh, of course.
Is it a hat? It's a hat, right?
Yeah, it is. Okay. I believe it's
a hat. I don't want to disrespect and think it's like a religious item and be disrespectful.
Right. Absolutely not. Speaking of greatness, Amanda Nunes is announcing retirement. Mm. Consideration.
Oh.
Let me be clear. So, UFC Women's Bantamweight and Featherweight Champion Amanda Nunes is considering retirement, mainly due to a lack of competition in the Featherweight division and forthcoming motherhood.
Mm.
Given how thin the Featherweight division is in women's MMA, the call is understood, especially given Amanda has just about cleared out the 135-pound division. What's your take on Amanda's latest decision?
I don't want to see her go. So much pleasure has been derived from watching her fight. Yes. What I like about her too is that she doesn't, she's not one of these fighters who is so arrogant and confident in her skill set that she's going to demean her opponent by trash talking. Like, there's trash talking that affirms certain fighters' confidence in themselves. And then there's trash talking that demeans another fighter. She doesn't demean the other fighter. She's very respectful, and she's very humble. But she's just like Khabib, man. She's going to give you 100%. When you see her fight, you getting 100%, and you know you better be ready to fight her because she ain't playing no games. She ain't worried about what you do well. You got to worry about what she does well. Same thing with Khabib. He ain't worried about what you do well. You got to be able to counter what he does well. So,
absolutely.
I hope she doesn't go. My prayer is that she stays around for a very long time because she is truly legendary. She's great.
Yes, she is.
And I want to see her be around long enough for somebody to come along and dethrone her because that will be a great fight. Mm,
that will be. That absolutely will be, and that will be quite momentous in UFC women's MMA history. Finally, in our Grand Panel segment, San Antonio Shooter is not a UFC fighter after all. So I'm not sure if you heard about this, but a few days ago there was a mass shooting in San Antonio. Mm. There was an inebriated patron who tried to get into Club Reber in San Antonio, and when he was denied, he shouted, "Don't you know who I am? I'm a UFC fighter from California." After being turned away, the fighter, or the alleged fighter, the gentleman, returned to let off a few shots. He injured 8 people. Janelius Crew, 37, was apprehended in Miami, Florida, and as it stands, all victims are suspected to survive. First of all, it's one thing to announce yourself. You know, I get some people could be arrogant enough to say, "Don't you know who I am?" I get that. And you can even disclose who it is you are. But when you say, "Don't you know who I am? I'm a UFC fighter from California." Okay, you're about to commit a criminal act. Why would you then disclose where you're from? Like, what is it you're trying to accomplish here? I was thankful. I don't know what prompted him to say that he was a UFC fighter, but it did. As a fan of this sport and as a fan that wants to see UFC reach a plateau of being considered a major sport, I'm glad that this attempted black eye on the UFC, you know, didn't stick. Any thoughts on the matter? Yeah,
you have to be kind of off your rocker.
Absolutely.
You know, so that kind of explains why a mass shooter would then want to affiliate himself with. I mean, I guess, did he feel like he would get more respect if I don't know. What can you say about the way a person who does something like that thinks? It's clearly he was off his rocker. So, you know, him proclaiming that he's a UFC fighter. So, I mean, you're holding a gun. It doesn't matter what you do. People are going to fear you. You're literally holding a weapon, man.
Holding the gun, right. Yeah.
I mean, it says a lot about a person's, I guess, psyche, if they literally have a weapon in their hand and they still desire more fear or respect or whatever they think they're garnering from people as they hold that weapon. So, I don't know. Who wants to dive into that person's psyche? I'm sure whoever his psychiatrist will end up being will have a lot of work on their hands.
Absolutely. Absolutely.